Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 155, Chauvinism, Clear Light, and Bliss in Buddhism.
Now what the fire puja is, okay? We make a fire there. We have a table with 12 different substances and objects, plus some kadaks and some flowers and some things. And what we do is we have some original invocation, and we invite Agni, the fire god Agni, the Vedic fire god, the Indian fire, not just Vedic, Indian fire god, Agni. You know, the word ignition is just Agni, that's the same thing. When I fly somewhere and land at night and I look at the lit-up city or whatever, I just see Agni. That's Agni. Agni's all over the place. And so we invite Agni, and we put a little kusha grass sitting mat for him on the edge of the hearth. And we draw a mandala at the base of the stack of wood, and which is then we invite Agni, the actual Agni, to be in that mandala, but we also invite Agni to sit on his goat with his cookie and his, you know, the way he looks. He rides a goat, or what's Agni, and to be present in the very like the Vedic thing. And then we do a round of the 12 substance offerings to Agni. And each substance connects to a certain type of purification, like some purify against weakness, some purify against sickness, some purify against sin. Mustard seed does, you know. Chickpeas purify against weakness and give strength, etc. Each one has its own, you know. Rice purifies against poverty and gives wealth. So each substance has a certain byproduct, you know, that it produces. And we offer them all to Agni, who is the fire, once we light it. And He likes to drink the ghee, melted butter, and we pour melted butter in his mouth, you know, and he blazes up in a jolly manner. And then we request Agni, who is also, remember, in the Kala Chakra Mandala. Both Mr. and Mrs. Agni are there in the speech and body mandalas. And those people in speech and body mandalas, although they look a certain way, like according to the picture, when they're in the mandala, they feel their Kala Chakra. It's not like Kala Chakra is more special than them. They feel they are Kala Chakra. They're totally initiated and they're gods. So they're very quick to get it, actually. They're actually not so bad. They're just a little lazy about it because they're so cool, you know. Or actually, Agni is so hot. So anyway, we then visualize that we mentally create in a creation stage a Kala Chakra universe in the heart center of Agni, who's crackling there as a fire, who has been offered those offerings, who has transmitted those offerings. And we imagine that the Kala Chakra deities, all 722, are in the Mandala Palace within the universe in the heart of Agni. And we then go through another round of the 12 offerings through the tongue of Agni and through his, you know, windpipe or whatever, his esophagus, and into his stomach. Into the hearth at his heart. And that's where the mandala is. And so we're making the offerings to all the Kala Chakra deities and the mandala is complete inside the heart of Agni. And we finish that round. That's the key round. And then we finish that round. And then we dissolve that mandala, and then we then give Agni a thank you round of the 12 things, and then the dedication, et cetera, and we enjoy. And the way we do it in the Menla habit, when we've done a retreat with people who are, even, you know, whatever kind, even if it isn't a formal Kala Chakra retreat, and they, and each set of offerings, we sort of pass around the little dish, and each person does a little bit of the offering. Whenever you do a full-scale retreat, you then make the offering as a, you're the one who actually is the main, you have the vajras and the bell, and you do the main thing. But since it's too awkward to try to do that, everyone participates in the way that we're doing it. Okay? So that's what we're going to do then, after lunch. Any questions? We have another few minutes for questions. Any questions? Yes. Microphone.
My question's about the Heart Sutra. Okay?
What about the Heart Sutra?
Yes.
Well, yeah, I'll include the Heart Sutra in the front of what I said.
Right, but my question is about the pronouns as they
about what?
The pronouns as they switch back and forth from he and to she and she to he. And
well, in Sanskrit grammar, like in English, with words like mankind, or when you say man, it's supposed to include women, right? Female, and even neuters, androgynes. But people don't really think that, right? They think man, it's a chauvinist, it's a thing like that. So humankind is the PC thing to do, and actually a good thing to do. But we're not used to it, so some people, they just say mankind, they don't mind. Well, Sanskrit grammar has case endings that are masculine, feminine, neuter. And in the grammatical sutras of the Panini, the Ur-grammarian, the mentor of linguistics, actually, on the planet Earth, the masculine case stands for the feminine. So they say as well, you know. So when the masculine case is used in a general sense, not for a particular person, masculine includes feminine. So we can do S/HE, for example. We could write that, but I prefer to alternate. And in the version you have, I might not have done where I'm alternating, but if you hear when I'm reading it, I'm alternating. She, he, she, you know. There's only a few places where you have that third person pronoun, but I do it like that. And I try to do that when I write. And when I, in my Tantra book on the perfection stage of the Unexcelled Yoga Tantra by Tsongkhapa called The Brilliant Illumination of the Lamp. Every time I put yogi / ni. You know, yogi ni. So it's both yogi. That's like a she-he thing because it's, you know, if you alternate yogi and yogi ni, it would be too confusing to people. They would think you were meaning a specific one. So there's the masculine case. The neljoba in Tibetan also is the masculine case. Pa instead of ma. They have neljo ma and neljo pa in Tibetan. That's masculine and feminine. But by Sanskrit grammar, it's supposed to include them both, but you wouldn't know that when you read it. So I try to do something. So alternating is what I like to do.
Okay, so you made a comment, and now I'm not.
They themselves have a corrective. From ancient time, however old the Heart Sutra is, from Mahayana point of view, Heart Sutra is 2,500, 600, 700 years ago. So Shariputra asks when any noble son, and he really says son.
Okay, that's what I wanted to know. Okay.
And when Avalokiteshvara answers, he says with any noble son or noble daughter. He does say that. And there is that corrective from the less. Because the dualistic Buddhism, I do believe, was more taught for the male Brahmin and Kshatriya, upper class people, who were the educated people, who were the first disciples, in a way, the surface disciples, and you know the Buddha, they are such a because India was very militaristic in Buddha's time. He was born as a general. You know, the crown prince was educated in a West Point setting, not in a Harvard setting, not in an Amherst College setting or a Smith College setting, in a West Point setting. And so he was dealing, you know, monasticism is the ultimate social antidote to militarism, without a doubt. And therefore, the main point was to get the men to be monks. That's why he wasn't that enthusiastic about the nuns, the bhikshunis, because they are more advanced, actually, which would no one but me will ever say that, probably, amongst Buddhist scholars, because they're still a bunch of chauvinists. But they're more advanced, so they didn't need necessarily to drop out so completely. But it was fine if they did, and he, once it happened, they went in a herd. But he knew they would go in a stampede because of the patriarchal family structure was much more oppressive to women. And so they wanted to escape from that family structure and be free of it. And the early bhikshunis, female mendicants, they sing the praises of the Buddha. Oh, I didn't have to cook lunch. I didn't have to pound the rice. My horrible husband isn't chasing me around the house. My mother-in-law is not giving me hell because I didn't have three sons yet, etc. You know, it's like, and maybe it isn't nirvana, but it's close enough. Thank you, Buddha. They write poems like that. But then he knew that would strain the tolerance of the dominant people of the society, which were the men, for whom the women are still slaves. Do you know the Marilyn Waring's book called Counting for Nothing, The Labor of Women? It's a marvelous anthropological, or sociological, I think. She's a sociologist in New Zealand, in some university in New Zealand. It's a wonderful book, but horrendously sobering about the state of our planet still today, you know, if you look really broadly, you know. And the male thing still controls everybody through militarism, and then militarism in your daily life, in the various forms of it, you know. Not only the defense budget, but the way we behave with each other. So, privileging anger and aggression and so forth, and competitiveness, you know. So, I don't know why I launched into that, I forgot. But yeah, even in the Mahayana corrective, though, there are some Mahayana sutras where, you know, still they say, well, are you going to next life be a man so you can attain Buddhahood? You know, the Tara legend is connected to that. She then says, hell no, I'm going to be a female Buddha, like, forget you guys, you know. But that's more exceptional, because even that literature is still in this culture, that is still written by men and managed by men, which is India, and still today. They got rid of Buddhism, and then the more chauvinistic Islamic culture showed up and put them even backwards than where they were 1,000 years ago. And then the British Victorian, they showed up, a bunch of uptights, right? So that's the thing. Okay, another question. And Tantra and the Vajrayogini is the final corrective to that. But look who likes the Vajrayogini, our motorcycle guy.
Hello, my question is, could you speak a little bit about the planets in regard to...
About the planet?
Yeah, and how the planets, like Venus...
I'm talking about the planet, but actually Sun and Moon are considered planets, too. And Rahu, the eclipse planet, or the lunar node, I think astrologers will say, and the other lunar node, you know, the Rahu and Kalagni, the tail and, you know, the lunar node. So they're deities. Sun and moon also are deities in that old cosmology. They're also planets, you know, right? And Sunday, Monday, as we still have in our popular, in our culture, Sunday, Monday, you know. The 7 days of the week are the planets, right? And they have the same set of seven, and they add Rahu and Kalagni, they don't have Pluto and Neptune, I guess, or whatever it is. But they have Rahu and Kalagni, so they have the same nine, actually. They connect to the cycle of breaths in a day, because there, you know, the 21,600 breaths that we breathe are like a circuit, a solar and lunar circuit around the constellations, the 27 houses, I think there are, of the constellations that, you know, which are the different constellations. There's the eight main, and the planets rule in those different ones. They have a whole astrology system that actually interconnects with what the Western people think is the Chaldean ones, you know, or Babylonian. And they think India did that. But that's because Western people always think everything happened in West Asia, Palestine, Egypt, They don't realize everything really happened in India, and it probably spread to Mesopotamia from the Indus Valley, actually. Because the biggest alluvium in the ancient world in Eurasia was India, the Indus Valley. And they did trade by sea with Mesopotamia, which was a lesser alluvium, and they connected over the isthmus, you know, to the Nile, which was also a lesser, 35 times smaller than the Indus Valley alluvium. And by alluvium, I mean a place that fertilizes itself every year and therefore can support a big population and therefore has cities and temples become big cities and they get into pharaohs and stuff like that. But in the case of the Indus, which was the most wealthy of them, they had a female pharaohs, it seems. Nobody seems to know. They can't seem to figure out the language or anything of the Harappan, what they call civilization. But what they have found seems to have big bunch of mother goddesses, you know, like they found in the Danube, and like the Chinese refer to as the Shang Dynasty, and the time when was the Eurasian city-state cultures were female goddess-dominated, and probably female priest-dominated, and less violent and so forth. And then nomad male guys came down about 5 to 10,000 years ago and started the current cycle of history that we're part of still, right? And the yearly months are in the body mandala and the navel chakra. 64 petals are in the speech chakra. And I think that's why the uniquely in Kala chakra, the throat chakra has 32 petals. In the other ones, it has 16, and there are 32 in the brain. But here, the speech one is very important. Resonating with the navel chakra, 64 and 32. And the planets are out here, along with other various kinds of deities. And the 27 houses of the constellations are out here and so on. And that part is very complicated. And we have to study the very difficult to understand fifth chapter of the Kala Chakra Tantra, which is the perfection stage, to sort of figure out how the planets figure in the body, you know. And therefore, Kala Chakra has a big, not only astrology, but astronomy system. And even though the world model is a different one, and it's sort of, you know, the Tibetans laugh about, ha-ha, yeah, we thought the world was flat, and His Holiness will say that to sort of give some solace to the Western astrophysicists. Oh, you guys have the right thing. But actually, their thing is relative, too, about the planets, right? They're undiscovering planets, and, oh, they're not really planets, they're clumps of ice. Oh, then we found another planet, and they're going on and on with their planets, you know. They haven't really got it pegged and nailed. They do not.
We got a question from the live stream. We have a question from the live stream. Question was, how best can someone prepare for the Kali Chakra coming? How best to prepare for the next Kali Chakra or any initiation?
How best to prepare?
Yeah.
Well, best thing to prepare is study, read Shantideva's Guide to the Bodhisattva Way of Life or Way of the Bodhisattva. There are a number of translations in all languages. Find out His Holiness's commentaries on them. Flash of Lightning in the Dark of Night is a short one. There's some longer ones. And read that a lot. And read the three principles and meditate the three principles of the path, sort of Lamrim kind of things, a lot. The Lamrim, you know, according to the majority order in the last 500 years in Tibet, the Lam and the everyone else, Pato Rinpoche's Words of My Perfect Teacher is a Lamrim, and all of the traditions have that. But that is considered the equivalent of like 100,000 prostrations, 100,000 things like that, if you really understand the whole Lamrim, and the selflessness and the compassion, Bodhisattva vow, and the renunciation and the transcendent. That's the best preparation. Then, if you read every book on the Kala Chakra and Tibet House and the Center for Buddhist Studies at Columbia and the American Institute of Buddhist Studies at the moment with the Center of Buddhist Studies at Columbia, all three together have translated now four of the five chapters of the Kala Chakra Tantra and its main commentary. And the fifth one is partially translated by a person called Newman, but never published other than as a PhD thesis. And it's only partially done because that dealt with the planets, and even that in astronomy side is very complicated. But they make the yearly calendar with that, and they predict accurately eclipses. They predict them accurately, of course, for India, because they were all in India. But they accurately predict that for for India and above going toward the North Pole, which they think is the south side of the axial mountain in that cosmology. And, you know, they know exactly when it shows up, just as we do with our model. They're just as accurate, strangely, you know, even though the model is different. And we've been flying around inside the model, so we think we know better, and we probably do. But we might not have the final thing. Actually, you can do a thought experiment on that. And the thought experiment is, you can look this up. And I used to have a list, and I don't remember it all by heart. But we are actually, if we were at the equator on Earth, we're moving around in the rotation of the planet where we think we're standing still. We're moving 1,000 miles an hour because we go around 24,000 miles in one day. So we're going 1,000 miles an hour around the planet. But the other stuff is going with us, so we think we're standing still, right? Then the planet is going something like 66,000 miles an hour in orbit around the sun. Then the sun in the galaxy is going like 250,000 miles, something like that, inside the nebula, the galaxy. Then even some people presume to dare to say the galaxy, Milky Way galaxy, is moving in relation to nebula in some other speed, huge bunch of relative speeds. So therefore, if you kind of try to visualize all these speeds, instead of thinking in a sort of vestige of terracentrism, that the sun is heliocentric, you know, we're sun-centered, and it is standing still. And then we're sort of going around, but really we're standing still. And the sun is just shining at us, and then, you know, we turn away from it at night and all this. But you take those relative speeds in a thought experiment, and Mars and Mercury and Neptune and these things, you know, Jupiter, we're all like going, we're all a bunch of ribbons all wound around each other. So therefore, the idea that Mars affects your liver, you know, that the sun affects your heart, et cetera, these kind of things that you have is not that far-fetched, really, because these giant electromagnetic bodies and gravity-warping bodies are all zooming around with you in some incredible, what is the final, ultimate relative motion of it all? You completely get lost of that. And there's no ultimate relativity thing. You know, the Westerners are so desperate. Oh, we can't see any planet beyond there, so there's only so and so many planets and stars in the universe. Nonsense. They just only can see so far because the others are running away too fast. And then dark energy is 97% of it all in dark matter, and you can't even see that. So where is the, who knows what's going on, really?
This podcast was originally live streamed from the Kali Chakra Practice and Study Retreat at Menla in Phoenicia, New York, July 24th, 2017, and was brought to you in part for the generous support of the Tibet House U.S. membership community and listeners like you. To access the full live stream archives, please visit the Tibet House U.S. membership archives at tibethouse.us. Free previews from the live stream archives are available on the Tibet House US YouTube channel. And now back to Bob with the second half of this week's podcast.
So these older explanations, they have some value, is all I'm saying. They are relative. They may not have value for certain things. If you want to send a ship to Mars, you know, because you're a billionaire, a tech billionaire, and you're feeling isolated and freaked out by your fourth trophy wife doesn't really like you, and therefore you want to go to Mars with Arnold, and have your eyes bug out and have a big fan blow and beat up people and whatever. So silly, you know. Never get there. We have to fix this one. This is the best one anyway. This is where Shambhala is coming. So, any other question? Yes.
I have one. Yesterday, you spoke a great deal about karma.
I can't.
You spoke a great deal about karma, and that was a very helpful answer. So my question is, the Dalai Lama speaks a great deal about happiness.
Yes. Or the addiction of hatred is like crushing some object in some way. These kind of happinesses are called the suffering of change because they don't last. The happiness of encountering reality, you know, of nirvana is the happiness. And don't think in the non-dual thing, don't think you are apart from nirvana. Your cells in your body know that they're in nirvana. That's why they keep recharging when you sleep and you get out of their way. Your consciousness of dissatisfaction and worry and depression and anxiety stops bothering them all, and they're all, you're in the clear light, and then they charge up because that's connection with reality, which is happiness, bliss. It's a happiness which is not changeable because it's not possessed. It's an infinite energy that you give yourself to. And you are all of it. You know, you give yourself to it, so you become all of it. And we all know that. We all have something that wells up from inside, from the heart, without necessarily getting anywhere. It's like, and it leads to, you know, that bumper sticker, random acts of kindness. It's like a random feeling of contentment. It doesn't really come from, but that random feeling of contentment is actually our health. That's actually the health of the body. The body knows it's there. The elements in the body, they know. There are some weird things creeping around in the body. There's like microbiome, there's bacteria, there's things, there's little mechanism, virus-like mechanisms. You know, and they're all out there like freaking out and trying to like eat something and therefore discontented. But what keeps them, what overwhelms their wish to kind of destroy, the, like become cancer and like destroy their host by addictive greed, is the sense of the infinity of each micro subatomic non-particle energy. And that the awareness of that. And that creates gravity, that creates electromagnetism, that creates all of that's the Ur energy there. But being Ur, it doesn't do anything because it's infinite. Everything's already done from that perspective. But the things that are not infinite sort of just get their toe in it mentally, and the human being is the one who can win their way back to it most effectively. Gods also, too, actually. But they're just lazy. They don't bother because they're too indulged. You know? And so that's what His Holiness is referring to, the art of happiness. Not the happiness of, I'm the winner, I'm the president. We can see that isn't happiness. It didn't last for one split second, did it? Not even a split second. No satisfaction there. And the billionaires, they don't have satisfaction. They need another billion. Go ask them. Go ask them for 20 grand to build a building. Oh, I don't know. Like, whatever is so important. But 10 grand is like 50 cents for a billion. But no, that's important. And they don't have three, you know. Warren Buffett has 40. Gates has 70. Now, Putin has 50. Dream up a mandala and Kala Chakra. Actually, see, that's the purpose of the creation stage. If you become adept in creating the Kala Chakra universe and moving yourself into it meditatively, so meditation is like a dream, it's like a bardo of meditation. It's one of the six bardos, for example, betweens, you know, one of the six betweens. And because you can, in meditation, you can sort of do out-of-body stuff at the advanced levels when you get really concentrated. And a little bit meditation is kind of out-of-body. Of course, it's done in an escapist way in the sort of main level of people who just meditate without knowing anything ahead of time. They, of course, feel a little buzz from meditating because they're actually trying to escape from their anxiety-producing environment. And that, of course, won't work really long run, so that's not even the most important kind of meditation. And even you can become addictive and you can become stuck in it and dull your mind and like, oh, Kala Chakra, oh, no, I don't know that, oh, no, I can't learn anything. You can't learn anything. So there's actually a negative effect of too much meditating if you haven't learned something. What you're doing, you know, that's why the Zen people are so brilliant. The sixth patriarch and all the great Zen masters, you know that story? Where within the real top tradition of the Zen people in China, the guy was meditating. He tells the story. Baijiang was his name. And his great teacher was the great master Ma. And he was meditating in an old ruined temple. And he was like, you know, icicles in his beard in the winter and whatever. He didn't care. Just, you know. And then at a certain stage, Master Ma came out of the little huts that they had up in that center and would sit near him and would pick up a piece of tile from the broken temple and take another thing and rub on the tile. Scrape, scrape, scrape. And then he would meditate. It was extremely irritating and distracting, but he would like be using it as a thing. No, I'm not going to be distracted by that. So then finally, it did get to him. He tells, as he tells the story, and he says, he distracts his meditation, and he asks his teacher, he says, "Why are you scraping on that tile?" And the master says, "I'm making a mirror." And then he says, "You can't make a tile into a mirror by rubbing it with a rock." And then the master says to him, "You can't make a Buddha by meditating." That's the Chan, which the name Chan comes from the Sanskrit word dhyana, which means meditate. Only wisdom creates liberation and enlightenment. Only wisdom. Meditation is just a tool in deepening that wisdom. But if it doesn't have the wisdom to deepen, it will deepen the ignorance. And this accounts for all these scandals and all these Dharma centers in Asia before even America. They meditated a lot. And then what do they discover after 20 years of really fell into mind? I'm the greatest! Well, that's where they started with naive egotism, selfishness. And then they become selfish, and then they're pain in the neck. But pain in other places, too. Very often, we see here when we hear about the scandals. Okay? So, why did I launch into that? What's the question? I'm sorry. What's the question? Oh, yeah, clear light. So the point is, that's a great question, because we're in, this is clear light. This is emptiness. Matter is emptiness. Emptiness is matter. Clear light is only the event horizontal way of expressing emptiness as not nothingness. It's pure light. And light has, even materialist science has the same paradox. They just sort of don't think about it because they have nothingness waiting. But the speed of light in the standard model, based on general relativity, et cetera, is 186,000 miles per second, although, do you know, something has never been measured as that. So it's something nearby it. And Rupert Sheldrake has a great thing in his book where he goes in England to the Bureau of Standards, and he says, how come it's 186,000 miles? Because nobody's ever measured it that. It's 185, 990, something like that. It's never measured 186,000. And then the guy there, the officer in charge, says, well, they are all wrong. Well, how do you know they're wrong? Well, because we say it's 186,000. That's how we know it's they're wrong. That's an evidence-based science, right? That's a dogma. But the point is, why is that an absolute? Because mass becomes infinite at that speed. And by the way, that speed is measured in relation to what? There's no ultimate frame of reference in the universe. So mass becomes infinite simply means that it becomes too subtle to find. So there would be no light because every light would be infinite and we would never, we would be blinded, all of us. We'd all disappear. And, you know, we see things. So light, we are light. We're interacting with light. We're interacting with a bunch of infinite mass. But we think we have a finite mass and it's measured against what? And the speed of light is measured against what? It's apart from you going 55 miles an hour or 75 miles an hour down the thruway. 186,000, wow. But that's just the boundary. That's what they're describing, is the boundary between the form realm, the Brahma heaven, and the realm of infinite space, the medium of infinite space, where there's no more sense of volume. But mind is there. And there's very subtle energy, too subtle for them to find. Disappears when they look for it. Now they're calling it dark energy and dark matter. Now they say 97%. They don't know what they're talking about, actually. So and the great thing is, I'm sorry, I don't mean to be too bombastic, I apologize. But I'm just saying, because we're ending, you know. So I'm saying we are the clear light. And that's the consolation prize. Knowing that is the consolation prize. Imagining it. You can't really know it yet until you know it, but you can imagine it. And then learn all the definitions. And challenge all the things that make you think it's not so, to get after your ignorance, criticize all of the conditioning. And then the consolation prize is when we know we're clear light. You know, when we've done the creation stage and the perfection stage, and we have reached communion, which means unity with everything and yet allowing everything to be itself, not trying to own any of it, giving ourselves, union with it by giving ourselves to it all, not destroying a single thing. That's nirvana, and that's the clear light. That's emptiness as clear light. And at that time, we were, I was always clear light, of course. This is not a created thing. This is the way it has always been. And therefore, when I was sitting at Menla at 11:39.223651, whatever, on planet Earth, in the year blah blah, and whatever it is, and Mars and Jupiter were there, and the other, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, it was already clear light. And then, so my feeling of antsiness, wanting to go for lunch, get on the bus, go to New York, get on the plane, all of that was like, unnecessary. I mean, I could all do all of that, but just like clear light, moving, care of happily, like a dream, easy going, you know. Very careful not to run into anything, because even though it's a dream, it's the metal part of the dream is not pleasant when it touches soft flesh and so forth. So I'm going to stay on my side of the road very carefully and very alertly. And I'll have that zinging happiness that is itself, doesn't have to come from anywhere or go anywhere. And then all my previous existences to infinity will become completely accessible to me. And I will revise my experience of being at Menla at 11:41 with that guy talking interminably and doing what's called an inconceivable liberation. It says that a bodhisattva in the inconceivable liberation can make a moment seem like an eternity. And that, therefore, all boring professors must be bodhisattvas in the inconceivable liberation, since their lectures are like, people are passing out in their lectures. And also, an eternity seemed like a moment. And so that's when when we're in nirvana, we'll be in nirvana now, when we reach it then. But it's our knowledge structure that makes the now and then different. For Buddha, then is now. All the thens are now. All our thens are now for all the Buddhas. So therefore, they're with us all the way through. And so we are on optimal path in that light. So that's my consolation prize. Okay? My sore back, my cramp on my left knee, my cartilage destruction from playing soccer and lacrosse, and bad karma of smashing the Andover guy with a cross stick over the head. And I'm actually really in nirvana. And that every bone and cartilage and stem cell knows it's nirvana. Stem cells are just those that are more aware of nirvana. So they're more resilient. That's all. Okay? Thank you very much, everyone. Now, we have to make a dedication. Always at the end of anything you've done, if there's anything good about it, you say, Gewa di nyurdu dag. Say it in Tibetan. Gewa di nyurdu dag. Duchi kolo tubjurne. Semjen tamsi deisa. Tanda nyurdu tubersho. So it means, by the virtue of this, by the skillfulness of this activity, may I become the Kala Chakra, and may I place all sentient beings in that exalted state.
weekly interstitial music provided by Tenzing Chogyal, used with the artist's permission, all rights reserved. To learn more, please visit his website at tenzingchogyal.com. This episode was recorded at the annual Tibet House U.S. Kali Chakra Study and Practice Intensive held at Menla in Phoenicia, New York, each year. To learn more about this Buddhist intensive with Robert Thurman and friends, please visit menla.us. To learn more about Tibet House US and the benefits of becoming a member, please visit tibethouse.us. Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode, and we hope to see you on March 3rd at Carnegie Hall as Philip Glass hosts his annual Tibet House US benefit concert and party. For ticket information and guest lineup, please visit tibethouse.us. Tashi Dalek.